today on Against the Grain. When an oil boom hits, workers are recruited and many of them die. Why is that? I'm CS. We'll revisit a conversation with Bruce Braun about capitalist dynamics and worker precarity in the Bakken oil fields and far beyond, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Oil exploration and extraction is a deadly business. Worker fatalities in oil fields like the Bakken of North Dakota can reach exorbitant levels. What does this say about the way the oil industry and processes like fracking work? What does it mean in the Bakken that oil is so difficult to extract that production rates from oil wells can decline precipitously, that getting oil on the market quickly is a top priority? According to Bruce Braun, the Bakken oil boom opens a window onto more general processes and dynamics, capitalist dynamics, that are otherwise hidden from view. Bruce Braun is professor of geography, environment, and society at the University of Minnesota. He is co-editor with Mary Thomas of the new volume, Settling the Boom, the Sites and Subjects of Bakken Oil, for which he wrote a chapter titled Crisis Ordinariness, the Bakken Boom in Late Capitalism. When Bruce and I connected recently, he began with this background about the space and place called the Bakken.
The Bakken is the name that's used to refer to an oil field in the northern and western regions of North Dakota. It extends into Saskatchewan and Manitoba in Canada and into eastern Montana. It's a region that is sparsely populated. It's sort of the dry, open plains. And the Bakken itself actually is named after a settler farmer on whose land the first productive well was drilled. The other thing that I would say about the Bakken is that it is a shale oil resource, which gives it unique characteristics. It's one of the places where fracking was first really put to significant use. Because of the time and date of the oil boom there, it really captured the American imagination. It happened starting around 2008 and then going forward, the major boom years up to about 2014. And that coincided with the Great Recession. And because it coincided with the Great Recession, and it was one of the few places in the country where there were a lot of jobs that were available, workers flocked to the area, and it was widely covered in the national media, the international media, and became fairly well known during that period, although it's probably receded from sort of the public imagination in the past years.
Was the boom that began in around 2008, was this the first time the Bakken fields yielded significant amounts of oil? And how does the amount of oil extracted from the Bakken compare with yields from other parts of the U.S.?
Yeah, so a couple things to understand about the Bakken is that it's not the first oil boom that had occurred in the Bakken. Back in the 1950s, there was a small oil boom. And then again in the 1980s, and these were based on conventional drilling methods. Basically, you drill down into the petroleum system and you get what oil you can get out. But because this was a shale oil formation, which means that the oil is really tightly captured or trapped within the pores of the rock, these conventional oil booms were short-lived, and they were really only viable when the prices were high. The most recent oil boom really took off around 2007, 2008, and it coincided with both high oil prices and with the introduction of new technologies, both horizontal drilling, which allowed oil companies to go down about 2 miles and then go horizontal through what was a very narrow band of oil-producing rock, and then the ability to frack the rock, which was really to introduce artificial fractures into the rock, which allows the oil to move. So starting around 2007, 2008, oil production really picked up. And one of the misconceptions of the oil fields in North Dakota is that the oil production sort of ended at a certain point. That's actually not true. The oil production has continued to the present and indeed has hit record levels in recent years. And that's because oil wells continue to produce. The major period of exploration and drilling was really from 2007, 2008, up to around 2014. And then there was a crash in oil prices and drilling really came to a halt. More recently, drilling has picked up again with higher oil prices and there's more activity in the Bakken. But around 2014, which was about the time that we were doing the research for this book, the Bakken was really facing an uncertain future. And this is because it's really in the exploration and drilling part of the cycle of an oil field that is the highest employment. And the municipalities and counties in western North Dakota were facing the inverse of the concern they had before. The concern before was the influx of workers and an inadequate infrastructure for those workers. And then by 2014, the question was, well, how do you keep people in North Dakota as drilling comes to an end? But oil production has continued. And in comparison to other oil fields, at the height of the boom, the North Dakota oil fields were producing less than Texas, but more than any other state in the United States. Some other states have now increased their production levels, and I'm not certain exactly right now where North Dakota stands vis-a-vis other states in the United States, but it's a major oil producer, whereas before 2007, 2008, it was really a minor player in the oil industry in the United States.
Now, you begin your chapter, it's titled Crisis Ordinariness, and we'll get to what that term means a bit later, but you start your chapter in this book, Settling the Boom, by describing narratives through which resource booms are represented to the public. I want to focus on the narrative that you focus on in this chapter, and that is resource boom sites as spaces of exception. What is the main feature? What are the main features of this narrative?
Well, this is a narrative that understands resource booms or resource frontiers as somehow fundamentally different than other spaces, and that the social dynamics and maybe ecological and political dynamics in these spaces are unusual or exceptional. And one of the things that I do in this chapter, and we can get into later, is to push back against that narrative, not because each boom isn't unique in its own way, but because many of the characteristics of what we see happening in these frontiers are actually related to broader shifts and changes in the national economy and so on. And a resource boom, these kind of spaces can be actually be really interesting sites that open windows onto these larger processes rather than being sort of these self-contained exceptional spaces. And, you know, the language of exceptionality can actually serve the interests of, say, the oil industry. And it's one of the things I get into later in the chapter is to talk about the way in which, by talking about oil frontiers as, you know, exceptionally dangerous or unusually dangerous, plays into the language of the oil industry, which sees these spaces or presents these spaces as inherently dangerous, and that it's the very nature of the oil industry and working with oil and working with these geological formations that produces the risk and the danger to workers, whereas we know that other oil fields elsewhere are not as dangerous. And so we have to think about, well, what makes an oil field dangerous rather than just accept that they inherently are dangerous. So the language of exceptionality can hide things from us. And that's one of the reasons why we want to push back a bit on the understanding of a resource frontier as, you know, a space of exception that is different in nature from other sites.
Bruce Braun joins me. He is professor of geography, environment, and society at the University of Minnesota. We are talking about a book he co-edited with Mary Thomas. It's called Settling the Boom, the Sites and Subjects of Bakken Oil. He wrote a chapter of the book. He also co-wrote another chapter, and we're delighted to have him on. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Yeah, on the question of danger, and specifically danger to workers, what should we know about the number and frequency of worker fatalities in the oil boom region of North Dakota?
Well, I think there are a couple things to note. The one was just a very high rate of worker injury and death during the height of the boom in North Dakota. And this was different than other sites of oil production in North America. It was also different than other industries. So there was something unique about the North Dakota oil boom in terms of the rates of injury and death in the oil fields. And, you know, one of the things that we went there trying to think about was what produced these conditions of risk and danger. And one of the things that we really dug into in that chapter was what we might think of as the way a set of different forces come together to produce that high rate of injury and death.
Yeah, I'm reading from your book here. In 2012, the statewide fatality rate in the oil and gas industry, specifically in North Dakota, was a shocking 104 per 100,000. Not only was this much higher than any other industry in North Dakota, but it was much higher than the fatality rates in the oil and gas sector nationally or in any other oil-producing state. Bruce, what did you find striking about how the story of these fatalities entered the public discourse in articles and documentaries and on TV?
Well, there was a lag time, first of all, before there was much attention being paid to these high rates of injury and death. It really wasn't until, I think, around 2012, maybe, I'm trying to remember now, this is now a little while ago, that some journalists started to pick up on the story. And these were both a documentary filmmaker in Minneapolis and some journalists from Al Jazeera. And what was interesting about the way that they represented it was precisely that they kind of talked about it as a made in North Dakota story. And in fact, John Oliver had an episode on this in his show where he really played up that theme, that there's something shocking about this, but it's also something that one can sort of write off as being just the sort of the wackiness of North Dakota that gives rise to this. And so there was a way in which the initial stories around this failed to connect what was happening in North Dakota with what was happening to the fate of workers around the country as a whole. And so one of the things that I do in this chapter is try to think this as more than a North Dakota story, as something that is tied into developments that are happening in the national economy, the recession, the precarity of workers, and the way in which those processes kind of intersect with an emerging oil boom.
Yeah, and one of the factors that you point to and that are part of this, what you call conjunctural analysis, this coming together of different phenomena in North Dakota, in the Bakken, is the way that the geography of this area is set up and the way that oil is extracted from the oil fields in North Dakota. Oil extracted from these fields is referred to as tight oil. What does that mean?
Tight oil, what that references is oil that is trapped in impermeable rock formations. And the reason why it's tight then is that the oil can't move through the rock formation. So if you think of a conventional well, you drill down into the oil-bearing rock, which is usually under a seal of some sort. So the oil and gas wants to migrate through the rock, usually up to the surface, and there's some impermeable seal that keeps it from doing so. You drill through that, and then that allows the oil to come out. With shale oil or tight oil, the oil is really stuck in the rock because the pores aren't connected. It's impermeable. So when you drill down, only that which is immediately next to the borehole is going to be released and travel up the well. So that tight oil demands a set of different technologies in order to extract it.
And here, are we talking about hydraulic fracturing or fracking?
Yes, exactly. So the two major technologies that were employed in the Bakken, and in many ways refined as technologies in the Bakken, were first of all the horizontal drilling, which was the ability to turn the end of the drill horizontal. Once you reach those oil-bearing strata in the formation, and then drill horizontally through that strata. And then the second is hydraulic fracturing, which involves, what they would do is section off parts of the well and set off explosives underground, which would introduce small cracks into the rock. And then following that, they would pump this high-pressure fluid that had the proppants into it, into these cracks to extend the cracks. When the water comes out, those proppants stay behind. And in a sense, they connect the pores. So they're overcoming the stubbornness of that rock and allowing the oil to flow. And then there are two other things to know about that, is that this uses an immense amount of water. And this water, because it's full of chemicals, but also because it also mixes with very saline water that's in the rock, is highly toxic. And so that creates a huge problem for disposal of this water. The second thing to note is that the oil then can come out, but only the oil that is proximate to those introduced cracks. And it results in a very steep decline curve in these wells, which means that there's a lot of oil that comes out right away, and then the amount of oil that comes out declines very rapidly, often as much as 70% in the first year. And the life of these wells is very short.
Yeah, does that mean that in the face of a production decline, more wells need to be drilled?
Exactly. In order to keep production level high, you have to be continuously drilling more and more wells. And there's, you know, another dimension to this that is unique to North Dakota, at least to the first years of the boom, and that is that many of the oil companies and the drilling companies were small companies that were, in a sense, left over from the earlier, smaller booms. And these companies really ramped up production, but they had to do so, they really had to obtain financing. They did it through going into debt. And so these small companies had to keep production levels going in order to service the debt. And I talk about this in the chapter as a drilling treadmill, that there's this imperative not only to drill, but to drill faster and faster to be able to get more and more wells online. And then there's a further imperative that comes out of the structure of the oil industry. So many of the oil companies would have the leases, but then they'd subcontract the drilling to drilling companies. And drilling companies, to be competitive, they had to drill quickly. In other words, they had to be able to demonstrate to the oil companies that they could get the job done, and they could get the job done at a price point that made them competitive. And to do that, they tried to drill the wells as quickly as possible. And one of the kind of things that is actually noted in the media and reported quite widely is that this was actually reflected in the structure of the bonuses that were offered to workers. So, for instance, workers would be offered a bonus for having a safe job site and a bonus for doing the job quickly. and what I would call a speed bonus. And the speed bonus was set at a much higher rate than the safety bonus. And so all the incentives were to drill these wells as quickly as possible.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Bruce Braun joins us. He teaches at the University of Minnesota, and he is co-editor of the new book, Settling the Boom, The Sites and Subjects of Bakken Oil, published by the University of Minnesota Press. He also co-wrote a chapter in that book, as well as single-authored a chapter that we are focusing on for the moment. It's called Crisis Ordinariness, The Bakken Boom in Late Capitalism. So, Bruce, workers migrated. They moved to North Dakota, at times in very large numbers, to take up these jobs in the oil fields, to participate in this oil boom. How important, given the cost of living, was it for workers who did move to North Dakota to get specifically oil field jobs and to keep their jobs?
That's a large part of the story. Cost of living in Williston was extraordinary at the height of the boom. There simply wasn't enough housing to go around. Rents in Williston were as high as they were in Manhattan. And this meant that workers that were traveling to North Dakota in search of work, and keep in mind that this is happening during the Great Recession, so you have a lot of people who are looking for work, their homes back at home, their houses are underwater with their mortgages, they're at risk of losing their houses. When they're in the oil fields, they really have to hold on to their jobs, precisely because of the cost of living and so on. And what that meant is that workers were willing to put up with quite a bit. When you're precarious and in a precarious situation, you'll do what you're told in order to maintain your employment. And the structure of contracts in the oil fields are what are known as at-will contracts, which means that these contracts can be ended at any point. They're not term contracts, they're not salaried jobs, they're at-will contracts. This meant that workers were willing to take on risk, and that's one of the parts of the story that I think is really important to focus on, is that you have a workforce that is precarious. That's the very reason that they're there, is because they're precarious. They're trying to earn money to send to their families, to pay off mortgages, to pay off debts, even to pay off student loans. And they're really trying hard to hold on to jobs in the oil fields. And that doesn't mean just jobs on drilling rigs. It could be jobs laying pipe. It can be jobs trucking and so on. And, you know, all of those had elements of risk involved, certainly on the oil drilling rigs, but also in the highways. And one of the untold stories in North Dakota, it got some attention, but perhaps not as much of attention as it should, is that basically the highway infrastructure was not meant for an oil boom. And so part of the high rate of injury and death was simply that workers were forced to use infrastructure that wasn't up to the standards needed to keep people safe.
Yeah, you're right about the long commutes on, as you said, inadequate highway infrastructure. You talk about the long work days in the oil fields, up to 16 hours in some cases. And you were talking about the precarity that these workers were working under, not just in the Bakken, but in where they originated from, in terms of, right, mortgages and debt and other things. I take it this ties in with what you are, the larger point you're trying to make in this chapter about larger forces that exist outside of, and in some cases far away from, the Bakken in North Dakota, that impinge, that impact on what's going on in these oil fields with these workers?
Yes, that's right. One of the things about the Bakken is that what workers were facing there was not necessarily dissimilar from what workers were facing elsewhere. Especially around the Great Recession, we were witnessing an ever greater precarity on the part of American workers. One of the things that scholars have thought about in relation to this is the way in which there's a certain way that workers are in a sense being worn out. Lauren Berlant calls this a kind of slow death that is part of, you know, the kind of overwork and the kind of stress of life as a precarious worker. And one of the arguments that I make in this book or in this chapter is that we have to see what appeared in the press as sort of very quick and violent deaths in North Dakota as on a continuum with the kind of slow wearing out of the bodies of workers elsewhere who were working two jobs or three jobs in order to make ends meet. Those are the same workers that went to the Bakken hoping to make money quickly in order to address their precarity. And so one of the arguments I make is that we shouldn't see these deaths as exceptional, but instead as opening a window onto a more generalized precarity. And so these fast deaths are simply, in a sense, the slow death that American workers face through this kind of attritional wearing out happening just at a much quicker pace when faced with these kind of violent endings in the oil fields.
You mentioned Lauren Berlant. She was a cultural theorist based at the University of Chicago. What did she write about the relationship between the ordinary and the extraordinary, and the extent to which precarity had been expanding since the 1970s, say?
Yeah, so Lauren Berlant, one of the points that she makes and that I build on in this chapter is that in many ways what we see as the extraordinary is really the amplification of something that, as she puts it, is already in the works. In other words, it's an amplification of processes that we see in more generally. And one of the arguments that they make, Lauren Berlant makes, is that, you know, since the 1970s at least, we've seen precarity moving up and shifting up from the working class to the middle classes. But in some ways, it was hidden for a while. It was hidden by the availability of credit. It was hidden by the housing bubble, by the importation of cheap goods. Some people have talked about this as the subsidy that's provided through these cheap goods by the hyper-exploitation of labor in the global south and so on. And one of the things that Berlant argues is that in this kind of context, economic crisis is kind of this context of precarity shifting up to the middle classes, that economic crisis has become almost every day. It's part of everyday life. It's what they call an extended crisis, where it's the events of every day, the flat tires, all the kinds of things which you're simply not equipped with either the money or the time to deal with, that just pile up. And Berlant writes a lot about this struggle to negotiate these impasses of the present, in which these fantasies of a good life, this possibility of a good life, is still held out for you, even though those fantasies are in many ways fraying. They're not as available as maybe they once were, but, you know, people are still searching and this kind of cruel optimism that good life is attainable. And, you know, in many ways, when we did interviews with workers in the Bakken, one of the things we noted was, you know, that they're traveling there because this good life fantasy is still present. It's still imagined as something that can be attained and marketed itself as the last great opportunity. In other words, kind of this last place where you can still realize this American dream. And that is one of the things that feeds into the story, is you have this ever-increasing precarity, you have the fantasies of a good life, you have workers migrating to the oil fields in search of that. and being willing to take on risk and being willing to take on levels of risk that they perhaps should not have been asked to take on, and to be able to manage that risk themselves rather than, say, industry assuring or being held to maintain safe workplaces and so on. Instead, workers were very much thrown to their own devices and forced to manage their risk in the search of trying to overcome the challenges of precarity that they were experiencing back home and which kind of drove them to North Dakota.
And I take it what you were saying about crises playing out in everyday life, this is part of what Lauren Berlant meant by crisis ordinariness?
Yes, that's exactly what Lauren Berlant meant by that term. And why I felt it was important to return to that in order to really situate what was happening within North Dakota within a larger context. And even, in a sense, open a window on something that is maybe not immediately visible when we look at everyday life. People persist. They keep carrying on. And we don't usually think of the language of crisis. And so looking at the way this manifests in very violent ways in the oil boom allows us to sort of pivot and look back and begin to see that this is really emblematic and an extension of a kind of crisis ordinariness that suffuses life for so many people.
Bruce Braun's solo-authored chapter in the book Settling the Boom is entitled Crisis Ordinariness, the Bakken Boom in Late Capitalism, the Bakken referring to the area mostly in North and West North Dakota, where there have been oil booms and a particularly large one beginning in the late 2000s, the decade of the noughts. The book Settling the Boom, Bruce edited with Mary Thomas. The full title is Settling the Boom, the Sites and Subjects of Bakken Oil. I'll ask him about the book as a whole in a little bit. He is professor of geography, environment, and society at the University of Minnesota. The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. So my understanding of what you do in this chapter is you not only want to bring Berlant to the fore and explain their ideas and notions of slow death and crisis ordinariness and their understanding of what the relationship is between the ordinary and the extraordinary, but that you want to move perhaps beyond what Berlant wrote. You write that, for example, that for Berlant, capital has an enduring interest in keeping workers alive, if just barely, resulting in the slow attrition that they chart. What's your take on that?
Well, in many ways, I think Berlant's absolutely correct about this, there's a certain kind of what we might call a biopolitics, which is a management of life where, yes, capital needs the laboring body and needs the worker to stay alive. Berlant says, if just barely, in the sense that, you know, in a basic way, the worker needs to stay alive. And one of the points that I make in the chapter is that Berlant and others have kind of contrasted this to what we might call a necropolitics, which is a politics of death, in a sense, of who can be killed. And they kind of resist that language because their argument is that this isn't about killing and killability. This is about keeping alive insofar as capital needs labor. And one of the arguments that I make is that what we see in the oil fields is actually that, in a sense, biopolitics at a certain point spills over into a kind of necropolitics. That what we might call a biopolitics of endurance at one site, or a biopolitics of a kind of managed abandonment at one site, becomes manifest as a kind of sudden and arbitrary death at another site, such as in the oil fields where you know, these very high-risk environments that are being produced by the oil industry, and I want to emphasize that, that they don't have to be these high-risk environments, that workers are being thrown into that, and there's a certain kind of letting die that's almost happening there, and that the line between keeping alive and letting die, or between a biopolitics and what might be closer to, you know, a necropolitics, just that line becomes blurred in the Bakken, and that maybe what we need to see is that there's a certain point where this precarity and a certain point where this slow death tips over into a fast death, where this wearing out of the body over time in this kind of managed abandonment is manifest instead as a very quick and violent death at these in these very high-risk environments. And so one of the things that I also want to think about as I say that is to say that if we understand this kind of crisis ordinariness as being part of everyday life, then what we're seeing in the Bakken is not outside of that. It's an extension of it. It's that crisis ordinariness leading up to the point of a kind of acute crisis, and the acute crisis of the worker's body being placed in harm's way. And so that's why I titled it Crisis Ordinariness, to begin to push back against this idea that what we saw in the Bakken was something exceptional, something extraordinary, or something even aberrant, something that wasn't happening everywhere. And the point is actually to say, no, what we see at the Bakken is a manifestation in perhaps a more extreme form of what we've been seeing in terms of the precarity of workers and the requirement that people take on more and more risk as they manage their lives in the face of this precarity. So it's that kind of continuity that links the Bakken and links what's happening in the Bakken back to larger forces. And this goes back to something we were talking about earlier, where the first people talking about this, these increased rates of injury and death, really told it as a made in North Dakota story. And the one thing I wanted to really push back on is to say, no, this is a national story. And it's a national story that the Bakken allows us to see.
And how does what you just said relate to the notion you touched upon earlier that oil fields are inherently dangerous, right? This is something we hear about and the industry propagates, and also the conjoining of blood and oil in U.S. culture and U.S. popular media, oil and blood sort of being thought of together.
So one of the reasons that I wrote this chapter was to push back at this idea that oil fields are inherently dangerous. That language of the oil field being inherently dangerous is what one which serves the interests of the oil industry. If we just accept that it's inherently dangerous, then we no longer have to actually think about the conditions that produce that risk. One of the interesting things about the coroner's reports for all these kind of workplace fatalities is that they always put the cause of death down to worker error, that the worker made a mistake. And what this does is it shields the oil industry from responsibility, for responsibility for putting workers into these risky environments. It also shields us from having to think about the larger forces that are forcing workers to take on these levels of risk. So I kind of riff on this idea of blood and oil because it's a trope, let's say, that is common in American culture, that when we think of the oil fields, we think of blood and oil. It's there in movie titles and so on. And one of the questions I ask is, what is it that brings blood and oil together? Why is it that blood and oil come to be associated?
You reflect interestingly on what might happen to the oil industry if worker safety were prioritized, if oil field productivity took a back seat to making sure workers didn't die, weren't injured, weren't exhausted, weren't subject to the kind of grueling routines that break bodies down. What is your sense of what might happen to oil and oil extraction if worker safety were taken seriously?
Right. So one of the points I make at the end of the chapter is that if we actually took worker safety seriously, if we actually regulated the oil industry, and if we asked the oil industry to, you know, pay the costs of having a safe workplace, or to pay the costs of having, OSHA be properly funded so that it could actually come and inspect workplaces, it would make oil that much more expensive, in the same way as if the oil industry actually paid for the externalized ecological costs of oil production, the costs of climate change and so on. If the oil industry was forced to pay those costs, oil simply wouldn't be competitive as an energy source. And so one of the arguments I make, which is, you know, a bit tongue-in-cheek, but it's also, you know, I think serious too, was that addressing worker precarity more generally and worker safety specifically in the oil industry might be one of the pathways to the abolition of oil. And what I mean by that is, in a sense, we subsidize the oil industry not just through direct subsidies and not just through letting them off the hook of paying the costs, the environmental and ecological costs of oil, but we let them off the hook and we subsidize the oil industry by not ensuring worker safety. And if those were really truly paid for by the oil industry, it would change the economics of oil significantly.
We've talked about just one chapter of your new book, co-edited with Mary Thomas. It's called Settling the Boom, The Sites and Subjects of Bakken Oil. What can you tell us about the sort of the main thrust and focus of this book?
Yeah, so the first thing I'd want to say is simply to give a shout out to Mary Thomas, who was, you know, really a driving force behind getting this book assembled and published, and did a lot of the writing of the introduction and had her own chapter in the book. One of the things we were trying to do in this book was really think about why a resource boom or a resource frontier takes the shape it does. And the title of the book, Settling the Boom, was really trying to get at the attempt to sort of channel these, you know, lively energies of an oil boom into a particular social and political forms. When we were writing this, it was, you know, after the boom had, in a sense, ended. Oil production was still occurring, but the boom itself had come to an end, or at least was winding down. And there was a great deal of anxiety on the part of municipal leaders and the state and so on to somehow sustain what had been happening. And we look at, in the book, at the ways in which efforts are made to, you know, sustain the boom, but also to contain the energies of the boom and to shape them into a certain kind of future. And the title of the book, Settling the Boom, is a play on settlement, on settler colonialism and so on. And I guess there are two things that we really focus on in this book. And the one is that the ways in which the boom both assumed and deepened and extended a settler colonial relation to land. Land understood as a resource, land understood as property, rather than, say, land as home or relation, and very much marginalizing other ways of understanding the land, other ways of being on the land, and the very fact that this was land which belonged to other people. So the continuity and extension of settler colonialism in and through the boom was one of the key themes of this book, and the way it relied on a narration of the past and the present and a future, a past that understood this through the terms of settlement, through the terms of the frontier, people like Lewis and Clark having a outsized kind of presence in media and in the museums and so on. And then the way that was connected to the present, but then the way that the oil boom was assumed to open up a futurity that was very much a settler futurity, say, rather than an indigenous futurity. And so we looked at that, and then we also looked at the way in which the boom reiterated what we would describe as a set of heteropatriarchal norms, and that those norms and establishing those norms and policing those norms was one of the ways in which leaders in, say, the city of Williston imagined setting the stage for this kind of settler future. In a sense, settling the boom, settling the disruptive energies of the boom through attracting families, families with children, setting up all the infrastructure that's necessary to attract families that would settle. And the assumption was that these would be white families, and all the advertising and promotional material of Williston and North Dakota was directed towards, you know, really producing a certain kind of future out of this boom. And we wanted to look at not just the boom as disruptive, but the boom as something which was being shaped and made to take a certain form.
And what are some of the other chapters in this book about?
So there's a number of chapters written by contributors who traveled to North Dakota. Some of them traveled to North Dakota with us and did research there. And, you know, I could say a bit about each of them. They're all fascinating chapters in their own right. Mary Thomas really spends her chapter looking at the centrality and the centering of a certain kind of heteropatriarchal white family as being what the sort of future Williston was going to be organized around. And the iteration and the reiteration of these kind of settler frontier narratives through museum displays, through the ways in which these pasts, these settler pasts, were being invoked as futures were being imagined, the attempts to attract white straight women to the Bakken as a way of, in a sense, settling this population of largely single men who had traveled to the Bakken looking for work. So her chapter is a fascinating chapter of just the sort of the normative discourses that were being employed in the Bakken to, in a sense, channel the energies of this boom in a particular direction. And the way in which that, in a sense, rendered invisible or drove underground other modes of existence, other ways of living, other forms of gender and sexuality and so on that did not conform to that. Thomas Davis, who is at Ohio State, looked at a series of films made about the Bakken and sort of examined the narrative arc of those films and started to think about the way in which those films presented the present in terms of hardship, really sort of got at that hardship, but also imagined that this hardship would be redeemed in the future, that one had to go through this hardship in order to arrive at this future, a future for oneself or potentially a future for your children and so on. And what it did was normalized oil as the route to that desired future. That, in a sense, to attain that good life, if you want to use the language of Lauren Berlant, that oil was the route to get there. And in his chapter, he kind of juxtaposes that with some indigenous artists, such as the Winter Count Collective and so on, who were doing their own artistic work that refused attachment to oil, refused that to be understood as the route to the good life, the route to this future, and insisted on the existence of indigenous modes of life in the Bakken, and that presence was there, but also the possibility and the necessity of indigenous futures, and placing those futures as being sort of understood in and with the land, rather than understanding the land as merely a resource.
Bruce, while I like and appreciate the level of detail, given that we are running short of time, I'm afraid you'll have to describe the other chapters in more summary terms.
So let me just touch on a couple other chapters. Morgan Adamson, in her chapter, develops this idea of Anthropocene realism. And, you know, again, like other parts of the book, she's really examining how it is that we're tethered to oil, and makes a really interesting argument that what we see in the Bakken is not climate denialism, but instead this kind of sense that there's no alternative, that one has to live in and through oil. And she calls it Anthropocene realism, riffing off of a concept by Mark Fisher called capitalist realism. Kai Bosworth has a chapter on the police reaction to the protesters at Standing Rock, and the way in which, in very interesting ways, it was the state and the police that presented themselves as being vulnerable to the violence of the native. And this kind of reiterated a whole frontier narrative about the vulnerable settler. And then I wrote another chapter with Jessica Lehman, where we explored in many ways what were moral panics around sex work, around the violence of the male migrant workers and so on. And the way in which that resulted in certain people being policed, basically the workers being policed, rather than, say, the oil industry being policed. And so we examined in that chapter the work that these kind of moral panics did in the context of the boom, such that they helped shape the outcome of this boom in particular ways.
Bruce Braun, Braun, professor of geography, environment, and society at the University of Minnesota. His books include The Intemperate Rainforest, Nature, Culture, and Power on Canada's West Coast. He's co-edited a number of books, including Political Matter, Technoscience, Democracy, and Public Life, and Environment, Critical Essays in Human Geography. We've been talking about his new co-edited book with Mary Thomas, Settling the Boom, The Sites and Subjects of Bakken Oil. Bruce, congratulations on the book, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
And that interview took place on February 7th, 2024. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.